The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Secure the Bag, Sis. Senior Money and Careers Editor Kimberly Wilson offers advice on alternative sources of funding for startups and businesses led by Black women. Can I be honest for a second? I'm tired of hearing how Black women don't receive venture capital funding to accelerate and grow our businesses. It is true that Black women-led enterprises receive just 0.27% of all U.S. VC dollars, and only approximately 100 Black women have ever received more than $1 million in venture capital funding, according to Project Diane, a biennial report on Black and Latinx women founders by the organization Digital Undivided. Still, there are several other funding options we can explore. When bringing up the stats, it's important also to explore the reasons behind them. For one, Black entrepreneurs receive less access to banking in our communities, due in part to a systemic history of discriminatory lending practices, which even now makes it harder for Black founders to secure loans or financial assistance. Unfortunately, I learned firsthand how arduous the process of raising capital can be. As a seed stage founder and CEO, I've raised $1.6 million in venture capital funding, and it was hard in those early stages of building my digital healthcare startup. Huge hundreds of investors told me they weren't sold on my idea pre-COVID-19. Potential funders insisted that there wasn't a need for personalized patient care for Black and brown communities. Another common refrain was that my business concept wasn't developed enough or didn't have enough traction. Did I mention that some white founders I knew were landing millions of dollars for ideas only drafted on paper napkins? So what did I do? I looked elsewhere, because as Black women, we will ultimately figure things out on our own. It just takes a bit of grit, patience, and resilience. After I secured alternative methods of funding to help build my business, many investors who were initially not interested began to take notice. That put me in a position to secure investors later who are better aligned with our mission and values. For my sisters who were looking to secure their own business bags, just know that there is hope. And it doesn't involve only venture capital, though that's what the playbook for running a successful startup would lead you to believe. Here are a few suggestions on alternative ways to get your startup or small business enterprise funded. Get funded. Join an accelerator. I started my business with personal funds, but that money ran out very quickly. Recognizing that I needed capital and additional resources in order to hire staff, learn the ins and outs of building a tech company, and get my business off the ground, I scoured networking groups and LinkedIn for incubators and accelerators to participate in. Apply for grants. Non-dilutive grant funding is a great option to help founders grow their businesses. Grants.gov, for example, is the holy grail of all federal grant programs from every eligible U.S. agency. If you are looking for government grants, let this comprehensive database be your guide. Participate in pitch competitions. Besides pitching your company to an audience of investors and potential customers, pitch competitions offer the opportunity to Home In On Your Brand Story. The next article is titled Charleston, South Carolina, Explore Centuries of African and African American Influence in One of the World's Most Captivating Destinations. Discover the Charleston area's rich history, culture, and authenticity. Experience a spirit of hospitality that locals call the endless welcome. History loves company. Learn about our rich African American history at chsvoices.com. The next article is titled, Black Authors Speak Out Against Book Bans. The manufactured conservative controversy against anti-racist education isn't stopping these black authors. The backlash against the teaching of black history in public schools has gained momentum in the form of book banning and objections to what conservatives have misidentified as critical race theory. While a CBS News poll found that more than 80% of Americans do not believe books should be banned from schools for discussing race and criticizing U.S. history, for depicting slavery in the past, or more broadly, for political ideas they disagree with. What's happening is the polar opposite. Republicans have continued their crusade of censorship in the classroom. Despite widespread agreement on this issue spanning the political spectrum and spread across all racial groups, PEN America, a nonprofit working to protect freedom of expression in the U.S., reported that since January 2021, 156 educational gag order bills have been introduced or pre-filed in 39 different states, and 12 have become law in 10 states. Essence spoke with some who are on the front lines, striving to ensure that our nation stays true to its ideal as the land of the free. As a historian, book bans are not new. Abolitionist literature was banned all across the South in the lead up to the Civil War, notes world-renowned award-winning scholar Ibram X. Kendi, Ph.D. Accurate teachings of the American Civil War, even slavery, were typically banned in many states during Jim Crow. Obviously, I was hoping I'd live in a time in a nation where we'd be willing to face the truth. But of course, I'm learning that people are trying to keep the truth and keep history away from young people, and it's both enraging and distressing. Ken Dye's work has been at the center of the right-wing misinformation campaign and book banning backlash. Conservative activist Christopher Rufo essentially concocted an uproar over a niche school of legal thought called critical race theory, created by scholars of color in the 1980s. Rufo conflated the theory with Ken Dye's popular books Stamped from the Beginning and How to Be an Anti-Racist, both of which gained visibility during the 2020 protest against police violence. The manufactured mania over critical race theory supposes this idea that critical race theory is widely taught in schools. Secondly, it presupposes this lie that critical race theory teaches kids that they are evil and racist, Kendi says. I think this just became the justification, and it's tilled the ground of these larger efforts to ban authors and to really terrorize teachers and make people tout this party line that apparently slavery and Jim Crow either didn't happen or have no sort of lingering effects, and that somehow there was not a group that was oppressed and there wasn't another group that benefited. A public school teacher who wishes to remain anonymous due to fears of retaliation, is troubled by the trend. Nobody wants to be uncomfortable, and nobody wants to feel like the bad guy, and I get that, she reflects. Even though Black history is old, the way people want to talk about it right now is new. So talking about Black Lives Matter brings up things like gentrification, redlining, gerrymandering, white privilege, cultural appropriation, and colorism. These are uncomfortable topics for a lot of people, but that's a part of Black history. Carolyn Bayron, best-selling young adult author of the recently banned Cinderella Is Dead, is also perturbed. I'm very concerned that what will happen is a kind of shadow banning situation where librarians and educators are pulling these books from the shelves because they just cannot understandably deal with the kind of backlash that they know is coming, she says. My biggest fear is that these young readers are going to be denied access to stories about people who look like them, who love like them. They're who I write for. That's my job. That's who I create these stories for. And knowing that they're being kept from them is very disheartening. Byron's fears are not unfounded. The anonymous public school teacher, who is Asian, described how the backlash has worked preemptively to censor educators, even if their teachings may be legal. I think in some ways my district would be perfectly encouraging of me teaching a book like Kendai's Stamped in my classroom, she says. However, I feel like they wouldn't have my back if somebody did react in a negative way. Even though no one has told me not to teach this book, and even though I do teach in a predominantly Black school, I feel like there isn't a protocol and procedure in place for me. If I am questioned, there's no safety net to catch me. If I am challenged by a parent, and so that makes me a little hesitant to be the pioneer. Author and activist Mickey Kendall is outspoken about this injustice. I think it disadvantages kids, she says. I know the ultimate goal isn't really about authors or about kids. It's about control. What we're seeing here is that these kids aren't being educated. They are not being informed so they can protect themselves. They say it's about safety, but they put more effort into keeping books out of schools than into keeping guns out of schools. And if that's not embarrassing and a shame to America, I don't know what is. In addition to bearing the brunt of book bans, there are inherent inequities around what it means to be a Black writer in contemporary times. There is something to be said about the fact that not a lot of white authors have to go through what Black authors are going through. And it's incredibly unfair, says best-selling young adult author Tiffany Jackson. However, I will continue to keep on writing. I think it's incredibly important for kids to see themselves on the page, but I believe that it's also important for them to see their peers on the page. These stories are important. They need to be told, so they can continue to ban me all they want. I'm not afraid of them. Author Jerry Craft has also been affected by the conservative outrage against teaching about racism in school. New Kid is the only book in the history of the world to win the Newbery Medal, the Coretta Scott King Author Award, and the Kirkus Prize, the only book ever, he points out. But instead of my being celebrated as a Black man who made history, nobody really knew that. I have received way more publicity from my book being banned. Kraft stresses the value of allowing kids to read these types of stories, mentioning that to this day, most of the books for Black kids are either history or misery. When you keep our kids reading those books, I think subconsciously it takes away our power and basically keeps other kids feeling superior. I have seen that firsthand, first as a kid myself, and now with my own kids. Kendai offers similar sentiments. Teaching about Black history in schools is key to mitigating racism, because studies show that when kids learn about racism, they are less likely to think lowly about particular racial groups, he says. Studies document that when kids learn about racism, it has a positive impact, and it also allows people, especially young people, to understand why there's so much racial disparity in our society, and to know it's because of the history of racism, not because of what's wrong with people. It allows Black girls, like my daughter, to learn that Black people don't have less because we are less, and that there's nothing wrong with you because of the color of your skin. The next article is titled, We Need Reparations, Not Just Representation. Juneteenth should serve as a reminder that reparations are a debt owed to our community for centuries of racist U.S. policies. State governments around the country began adopting Juneteenth as a holiday shortly after the high-profile police killing of George Floyd in May 2020. And while Congress is prone to move at a glacial pace, it too acted swiftly to pass a bill making Juneteenth a federal holiday. America could use a day of observance to acknowledge the toll of our ancestors and the day some became aware of their freedom from slavery. Although many Black people freed themselves before June 19, 1865, by escaping plantations or joining the Union Army to liberate each other, a designated day to commemorate our freedom is certainly worthwhile. But we have to move beyond a symbolic acknowledgement of our historical pain. Juneteenth should also be a time to fight for the debt owed due to centuries of legally mandated servitude and the decades since, during which government policies have deliberately kept Black Americans from ever catching up. The economic loss for millions of Black families wasn't just a symbolic one that can be repaid with holidays, plaques, or statues. Trillions of dollars of Black wealth have been wiped out while government officials advanced wealth for white households before Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which only freed enslaved people in some states while allowing slavery to continue in others. He signed the Homestead Act of 1862 to give away land that helped mostly white people expand and settle westward. While Black families weren't legally excluded by the act, only a fraction were able to benefit from it. As historian Carrie Lee Merritt notes, more than 270 million acres of land were given almost exclusively to white households, including to immigrants. Today, nearly a quarter of U.S. families are descended from the recipients of these land grants. Government policy has continued to widen the racial wealth gap through housing laws in the New Deal era, discriminatory wage scales, or miscarriages of the criminal legal system, which deprive Black households of reliable breadwinners. Duke University economist and scholar William Sandy Darity, Ph.D., calculates that reducing the gap now will require granting individual Black households assets of about $250,000 each, which would amount to $10 trillion to $12 trillion paid by the U.S. government. As scholars have made clear, we can't educate our way out of this problem, especially when indebtedness seems to be the inescapable cost of higher education. As the 2018 report, What We Get Wrong About Closing the Racial Wealth Gap states, on average, a black household with a college-educated head has less wealth than a white family whose head did not even obtain a high school diploma. We can't close it by mere home ownership or entrepreneurship either. According to the same study, among households that own a home, white households have nearly $140,000 more in net worth than black households. Add that to the fact that large-scale entrepreneurship tends to expand wealth among those who are already in the upper class. While such measures may help some black people, they are unlikely to lift the masses of us into wealth equality. That is why this year, for Juneteenth, we should continue to demand more than symbolic gestures of our emancipation. Without a systemic investment in black households, we may never truly be free. The next article is titled, What's All the Buzz About? IMG model and illustrator Monica talks about her decision to shave her head and why she's planning on keeping her hair low. In 2018, Monica was working nonstop. The former DreamWorks animation employee and USC School of Cinematic Arts graduate was building a portfolio of her pop art style vector portraits. And for a hustler like her, launching her brand was all-consuming. Each day's hourglass felt bottom, heavy, and with such a full schedule, Monica simply didn't have the time to primp and prime her hair beyond box braids and extensions. Shaving her head changed everything. When a popular women's media site approached Monica about cropping her hair for a digital feature that ultimately gave the artist the fuel to make the big chop. Before that, however, the idea had been stirring in her for a while. I was so willing to do it because for years before, I had wanted to shave my head, and I'd always told myself I would do it when I turned 30, she says. I don't know why it felt like I needed to hold off until then, but when they asked me to do it at 27, I just felt like, you know, why not just do it now? Prior to then, Monica said she had avoided focusing on her hair because life was just that busy for the full-time freelancer. Cutting off her hair gave her one less thing to do. Celebrities across generations, including Cicely Tyson, Solange Knowles, have rocked buzz cuts, though the choice hasn't always been supported. Upon cutting her hair in 2009, Knowles was unfairly criticized by the media, to the point that she felt the need to share a few tweets about the negative attention. I'm not trying to make this a style or a statement, she wrote in one post. I just wanted to be free from the bondage that black women sometimes put on themselves with hair, she said in another. Of course, women have been voluntarily shaving their heads for centuries, often challenging ideas of femininity based around hair. Head shaving has even been perceived as a sign of mental health crisis, with the unfortunate negative judgments many attached to that, rather than as a reasoned personal decision. Asked what needs to be done to make head shaving less controversial, Monica is reflective. I think it's just more people doing it, she says. It's about having those examples that people can look up to from all ages. She cites Kiki Palmer, Swati, and Sanaa Lathan as just a few of the women who have decided to drop the top in recent years. As for upkeep, Monica had to learn to maintain her cut after barbershops closed their doors during the earliest days of the pandemic. She purchased the same brand of clippers that her brother used and had them teach her the tricks of the trade via FaceTime. Now she's a pro. Every time I did it, I kind of just got better at it and more comfortable with it, she says. So now I pretty much do it myself. I probably give myself a trim every 2 weeks because I like to keep it super low. 4 years after her first cut, she says she has kept the look because it's become married to her identity. She calls the long-haired version of herself a whole different person and shares that with her shaved head, I just feel very much like myself. 3 cheers to all Black women who, like Monica, are getting to the root of their freedom. The next article is titled The Evolution of Black Moms on Screen. Cultural critic Zeba Blay examines how character portrayals from Julia to Rainbow and of every Black TV matriarch in between have reshaped motherhood right in our own living rooms. There was a time when TV moms all looked the same, a homogeneous parade of white homemakers in perfect dresses with identities revolving around being wives and mothers and not much else. But since the 1960s, there has been a steady stream of Black moms on television who have redefined and expanded depictions of motherhood. These moms, from Flora Evans to Cookie Lyon, have reflected the role in ways that are uplifting, inspiring, flawed, and real. We've come a long way. This year, two of the most iconic moms of the last decade, Rainbow Johnson from Black-ish and Beth Pearson from This Is Us, bid their farewells to audiences. As they pass the torch, here's a look back at some of the seminal Black TV mothers who have paved the way. 1960s, Diane Carroll as Julia, 1968 through 1971. In 1968, Diane Carroll made history by becoming the first African-American woman to star in a weekly primetime show in a role other than a domestic worker. Though lighthearted and sentimental, the series didn't shy away from some of the struggles of Black women at the time. One episode found Julia in danger of losing her job after the clinic manager ordered the dismissal of all minorities on the staff. 1970s, Esther Roll as Florida Evans. Good times, 1974-1979. Times were not always good on the beloved 70s sitcom, but that did not stop matriarch Florida Evans from leading her 3 children through tough moments with a sense of determination and love. Behind the scenes, Esther Roll was just as determined as her character. She fiercely challenged Norman Lear to tell timely stories without relying on stereotypes. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.